kind of like to say that my life has been a bit of a duality for the last couple of years. I've been, on the one hand, working on highly technical things, and on the other hand, working on highly political things. You can guess which one represents which. But essentially, it's a very long, complex tale of interconnections through various projects, and it just gets more complicated every day. But essentially, what it started out as is, I kind of like got into the entire free software movement about a decade ago, and got like really interested in how software works and that kind of thing. And the more I learned about it, the more I got involved in this entire freedom debate. And I always like this this quote, because it kind of explains more or less everything that what I'm working on represents. And of course, I had to put this one here because we're in England. I really don't like this kind of thing. But the thing is, the entire battle for freedoms and all that is it's always a long and bloody battle. There's some of them are more famous than others. This is from Chicago, the Haymarket Massacre. And it seems that, you know, when I was working on the entire free software thing, I was completely oblivious to the fact that really the freedoms are not as easily defined as you know, free software people like to think. And I mean, this one is from Iceland. This is the first occasion of two that tear gas was used in Iceland. The second occasion was about a month or two ago, just before our government collapsed. So, you know, through this entire thing, I got into realizing that the more technologically advanced we get as a culture, the more our physical freedoms, in the sense of what we can say politically, what we can do within our base systems, they're all always hinging more and more on the freedoms we have in the digital realm. So the question came up, how do we push all of that stuff down into the physical world, all the stuff that we've been doing in cyberspace for a couple of decades and doing pretty well with? Because free software is a very solved problem. We know how to do it. We've got really smart models. Yes, there's still a lot to research in that field, but you know, the more we get into the physical realm, the less freedoms we really have. So I got involved in this Fab Lab thing, which is all about taking the entire concept of manufacturing and pushing it down into the level where individuals could participate. And it kind of, like that there picture is the total idea. You kind of just design something, you code it, you print it. And I often joke that my work in that field is done when I can download a chicken sandwich off the internet. So to explain the picture here, one of the more interesting projects that has happened was in the north of Norway, somebody decided to build GSM phones for sheep just to hang around their necks and transmit, so they can call up the sheep and get GPS information about them. And there's been all sorts of similar projects. And it all comes back to this little thing. Back in the 50s, I think it's 1954, that the first CNC milling machine was created at MIT. And it was huge, it sucked, and despite the best efforts of everybody, this technology still sucks. We're at the point today where, yes, we have rat wraps, but, you know, has anybody used a rat wrap? Oh, great. You know, wrap wraps are really, really cool because they print stuff and make 3D objects, but they're remarkably hard to get a hold of, and they're very young technology. And even if they stop being young technology, they're still, at the end of the day, fused deposition modeling tools, which means that they're going to be very granular, and you're never going to get you're never going to be able to print out chicken sandwiches with that kind of technology. So there's a lot of work to be done. And this Fab Lab thing is a dual-pronged approach. On the one hand, it's just pushing forward the technology, trying to get the wrapper up to do everything that wrapper up should, trying to get the magical Star Trek replicator kind of thing. But on the other hand, we're trying to push the available technology out into the field as soon as possible in order for basically everybody to understand what the implications of this technology is. And you have to ask these questions like what happens if the molecular assembler, the perfect molecular disassembly device, comes into existence tomorrow? How will society react to that? Will people in general be able to handle that kind of transformation? I mean, what happens if some company comes up with a technology and patents it and says, no, we're not going to share the technology with anyone, we're just going to have a monopoly on making everything for a couple of years? And that kind of thought is very scary. So the entire Fab Lab concept is, to me, it's kind of just making sure that by the time this technology appears, everybody will know exactly how it works. And that's a very important thing. So this is a open source design of a CNC mill that we were playing around with a while ago. Martin's not here, no, okay. And this here is a project we were doing in Afghanistan a couple of months ago, well, in January. I kind of missed the Icelandic Revolution because I was doing this. And to explain, these are directional parabolic antennas built out of plywood and chicken wire mesh. It's as cheap and simple as you can possibly make it. And we're spanning 4 kilometer links with chicken wire mesh. It's completely insane. And what we did during the course of 2 weeks was, with 7 people, we kind of just carpeted an entire city with free wireless internet, and for that, for about $40,000, including our flights, which were the most expensive part, the food, the hosting, etc. So with that thing, we showed not only our Fab Labs actually capable of doing cool things, but they are also capable of doing them far better than the aid agencies, etc., that have been sitting with hundreds of employees for years with nearly unlimited budgets. They haven't, to my mind, had any really cool success stories like this. But this entire thing just, the more I got into this entire debate, the more I learned that at the end of the day, it isn't about really cool technologies, about being able to print out stuff. Because, being able to print out chicken sandwiches won't change who we are as people. Like, society has chicken sandwiches. They know what they do for us. So I kind of got into reading all the old literature, and it turns out that all the really cool ideas that are coming out, they're all 200 years old. We're not inventing anything. We're just implementing it. And, so I had to start asking questions about food. And it came down to the point where I was faced with 2 underlying assumptions that are basically underlying everything in society. Every single thing in the way societies function nowadays are based on 2 lies. And I call them lies because I think that they may have been well-intentioned originally, but they are very, they've become such an integral part of how society is defined that they have the same effect. And on the one hand, there's Hobbes' lie, which narrowly, really condensed, is without a strong centralized government, humanity will essentially go into chaos, a bellum omnium contronis, war of all against all, and we will all die. I kind of don't really believe that's going to happen, and the fact that we have the free software movement at all, kind of points out that that isn't the case. The other lie is that without a strong centralized government or some sort of method of restricting the access to resources, then people will use them all, finish them, and then we'll all starve to death. So either way we die. And of course, Christian mentioned in his last thing, Gerd Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons, which is essentially a modernization of that lie. And now, of course, the fact that I'm saying that these are lies kind of needs some sort of justification. So I'm going to cite a few statistics. The first statistic is food, because food is something we all need and that kind of thing. So according to the United States Agricultural thing, agency, the annual produce of vegetables worldwide is about 6.2 billion tons, metric tons. And the average consumption of food of a American is 884 kilos of food a year. So if you divide that, you'll see that there's more vegetables than all of humanity needs to sustain themselves. And we haven't even counted meat, fish, dairy products, eggs, you know, that kind of thing. Yes, a lot of the vegetable produce goes into raising animals and stuff, but, you know, at the end of the day, food does not appear to be scarce. And what more, about two-thirds of all food that's produced in the world is thrown away every year. That's, and, you know, if anybody's ever gone dumpster diving, then you'll understand what I mean. It's not just at the production point where the farmers are throwing away stuff, for example, in the United States, where they just get paid more money for producing less stuff, but also in supermarkets where they find one rotten apple and just say, okay, there might be more rotten apples statistically, so let's throw the entire batch out. And it just doesn't really make sense. You can go through similar statistics with building supplies, with concrete, with wood. There are definitely some kinds of wood, like mahogany, that are becoming endangered and so on. But what it all comes down to is the fact that there's currently about 80 million people who are below the hunger threshold. There are about another 8 million that are in subprime living conditions, like don't have roofs over their heads or whatever. And none of this needs to be the case. And, well, there's basically the problem is distribution systems, and both Karl Marx and Adam Smith and all these other theorists wrote extensively about how the entire distribution problem was the only remaining problem in their ideal models. So, I often mention veganism, this is a two-part dumpster diving, as the perfect social phenotype for there being abundance. That is to say, there's so much stuff that we don't even need to work, we can just go out and dumpster dive for it, you know. So we kind of need to define scarcity, and I ventured on this kind of definition that you may or may not agree with. But the method of this definition is to say, can it be depleted sensibly? Or that is to say, if we use it sensibly, can it be depleted? And then, alternatively, the concept of rivalry. Does the use of anything preclude the use of others of the same thing? Which, for free software, for example, or software in general, software is not rival. Anybody can copy it. Whereas this chair here, it's quite rival. You know, if I sit on it, you can't. Ha! And I kind of put up this little two-dimensional graph where I kind of put in loads of concepts that, you know, some are rival, some are not, some are scarce, some are not. And, there are some things that are inherently scarce. The Eiffel Tower is inherently scarce. There will always be one Eiffel Tower. You cannot copy it. If you copy it, it isn't the Eiffel Tower. It's just copy. You know, that's just because it's defined socially, like, through its history and its what it is. And the same goes for 15th century manuscripts. If you make a new one, it isn't 15th century. It's just a replica. Yeah. So, on the other hand, there's, like, a bunch of stuff that isn't scarce. Music isn't really scarce. You can never... None of us can ever sit down and listen to all the music that's ever been produced. But on the other hand, you could say that good music is scarce. Okay. So, you know, at the end of the day, it all comes down to this. And you know, when dealing with this kind of thing, I kind of got challenged with how do we fix it? How do we break the assumptions of Malthus's lie, of Hobbes' lie, you know, break all this weird stuff that's going on? And, you know, and it's affecting a lot of people. And you might see that these two don't really match up. So Human Development Index and Gini coefficient, they kind of, Gini coefficient, for those who don't know, is like a measure of relative inequality, while the Human Development Index says whether or not you're going to have food on the table. And the story so far is essentially that its scarcity is artificially maintained. Like, we know that there isn't any scarcity. It has been measured. Regarding the agriculture thing again, the paper by Perfecto et al. Showed that you could easily quadruple the world agricultural output, that's vegetables and beans and so on, by just switching to organic fertilizers. Something that, you know, seems so obvious that nobody has ever tried it. Or very few, and they're normally called quirks, you know, crazy people. So, you know, we're involved in this entire social movement where we want more freedom from oppression, we want more freedom to do whatever we want, and everything in between. And it's kind of like a stack of freedoms, where at the bottom you've got like the freedom to exist, the freedom to have physical form, freedom to, you know, radiate electromagnetic radiation into the atmosphere or environment. And, you know, the higher up you go, you get into more abstract things like, for example, the freedom of speech, which is very abstract. You know, it's something that you need to be a very high-level organism to be able to comprehend what it is, let alone have it. So consumers entrusting our planet, economical underpinnings are relying on continued subservience, and we all want to make this new industry 2.0, where we redesign the industrial revolution to service the needs of those who actually need it, as opposed to the companies that have, you know, had a really great time for the last 200-300 years just using us. And the guy that came up with this term, non-exotic objects, as to say, exotic objects are things like the Eiffel Tower that, you know, are always scarce. And it came down to a couple of things. I kind of mapped out like 9 origin points of what needs to change if we want to change the entire distribution of goods, if we want to level up the distribution of wealth. And the first thing that, you know, came to me one night was that the law is essentially a social software project. It's code, legal code, that's running on top of society, and anybody could essentially change it, but no, it, even though it exists in the public domain, as to say the law is freely copyable, etc., it's developed by a committee, and the committee decides what gets to be in there. And it's also self-modifying code. That is to say, every time something changes in the running of the society, some back effect or like rebound effect from the parliamentarians or the whatever causes the code to change. And laws take effect, they start running on top of society. We kind of can't really do much if the law turns out to be really bad. So modern democracy... Oh, I forgot to translate that one, sorry. To translate, modern democracy, at the top you have a legislative parliament, below it you have political parties, and then way below them you have people at varying degrees, depending on how important they are. And, you know, we kind of have to ask, can we do this better? Well, the internet already has, with mass media and production and knowledge. Sorry, I'm going fast. I mean, we've already democratized mass media. We've already democratized production. We've democratized knowledge. So when are we going to democratize democracy? Okay. It's a nice idea. It doesn't work, right? Never mind switching. So this is what people have been saying. Like, direct democracy, it just doesn't work. And people can't keep up with every issue, unless they're parliamentarians, but they're special somehow. I really don't understand this logic, but, you know, I'm willing to, you know, say, okay, you know, you might be right, so let's find some middle way, some middle ground. And when you go to vote, when you're participating in an election, you have two options. You have the option to participate, select yes or no. You have the option to abstain, as in, you know, put in black vote or just not show up. And, you know, what happens if we add the third option? Proxy. Allow somebody else to vote for us. Like, just say, I don't know about this issue. I just don't know what to do. So what happens if I give it to you? You know, I could do it generally. I could say, I'm apolitical, but, you know, you're a nice guy. I trust your opinions. We could also do it categorically. I don't know anything about agriculture or health services or whatever. Yeah. But I kind of trust you, you know. Or you could do it on a per issue basis. Sorry, I'm really busy, can't get myself into this, but, you know, I feel this is an important thing and I kind of trust your judgment on this. And at the end of the day, that's what it's about, because when we're electing representatives in a representative government, what we're trusting is not their ability to make the right choice, but their ability, we're trusting in their judgment. We're trusting that overall, they will most often take the right choice. And of course, what happens is that if anybody's been drawing a picture, it turns out that this is a directed acyclic graph. That is to say, you've got loads of nodes which are people, and some of them are voting directly, and the other ones are creating edges between themselves, saying, "I'm going to, you know, go, you know, trust this guy." And every single form of government we've ever seen on in the history of the planet exists as a possible state in this system. And we also get a load of really new and freaky ones that never would have made sense as political doctrines. But the most easy one is the dictatorship. Everybody forwards their vote to one person. Never mind why they would do that. Some people are crazy. The less obvious one is the representative democracy, which, you know, judging by this, turns out to be some sort of highly advanced form of dictatorship. You've got, sorry about that. Because even though people are voting for different parliamentarians, then at the end of the election, once the votes have been tallied and the people get their seats, then you've got essentially a mapping from voters to votees, or, you know, from people who are casting the vote to the people who are going to make the decisions. This here is the case study of Iceland, a representative democracy with 63 parliamentarians. Is that necessarily better than, what about this? It looks a bit mad, doesn't it? It's a kind of adhocracy. You've got people that are voting, you've got people who aren't, you've got people who are forwarding their votes to each other. It seems a bit crazy until you start asking questions about the structure. Now, I made a mistake in this one. Do you see it? That could never really happen. And, you know, if we were to imagine this as a software system, then once somebody creates a loop, then they would get a warning like, you created a loop! Please destroy the loop. And, you know, of course they will. So, somebody will have to destroy the loop, otherwise all of the members of the loop are essentially abstaining from voting. And these people here, they're the people who are making the decisions in the system. They're the people who are making the end final calls of what gets to be the law. And once you have this kind of system, you need to be able to change your mind. It's very natural to change your mind. I mean, I do it all the time. I've done it 3 times today. And, you know, the modern democratic systems, they assume that you can't change your mind. Once you put your vote into the ballot box, you cannot change your mind anymore. It's just fixed. Because, you know, they're not going to let you go fishing after you vote to change it. And what? No. And, you know, it's just technically not possible today. But with strong public key cryptography, we can actually do it. It's like the technology for doing this exists. We can say, I'm going to vote on this issue. No, I've changed my mind. Okay, I'm changing it back. You know, you can do it as often as you like. And by allowing people to do this, you get a lot of free features. The first one is that you can no longer force opinions on people. That is to say, I cannot come up to Martin with a gun and say, you are going to vote for this. Because, you know, as soon as I leave, you know, he'll change his mind. The second thing is that changes in trust lead to changes in structure. If I suddenly stop trusting the person that I'm proxying to, the entire structure changes, and suddenly the entire format of how the law came into effect changes with it. The third thing, which I think is more important, and it's kind of the meta thing with this, it's democracy evolves over time. We've got ourselves locked into this idea where democracy is just something that's really fixed, really well defined, and you know, if it's broken, then so what? But you know, by allowing democracy to evolve, we gain a lot of leeway. And this has already been made. Thing is, I started throwing this idea around with a couple of friends back in October when the Icelandic economy went boom, and it turned out that two separate groups went off into separate directions and wrote code, and now we've got this website, direct.democracy.is, that is implementing all of the features of this democratic system that I've already mentioned. It's currently taking like a live feed off the actual Parliament website, dumping them into categories, trying to line everything up. We've even got video feeds going, and you know, it's really, really cool. And people can actually participate. It's all in Icelandic, but you know, whatever. But there are many questions in this. Like, okay, if we're taking just from the Parliament, who gets to make motions? Is it just the parliamentarians, as it is in most countries? Well, why not everybody? What happens if we let everybody raise a motion? The legal code becomes like a wiki. We get all the features of a wiki where the official version is just decided by the votes. And it becomes a free market of motions, and everybody loves free markets, right? You know, everybody can participate in making a motion and just throwing it out there and seeing what happens. And then there's a popularity roundup. We get like a Reddit-style thing where the really, really cool motions bubble up to the top and the bad ones just lie down there somewhere. And, you know, how long do motions stay open? Why need we put arbitrary limits? We can change our votes whenever. So, like, how about when motions have enough support, they become the law? If the support wanes, you know, then they just stop being the law. And you can put all sorts of dampening rules that make sure that laws don't fluctuate in and out, but I don't really think they're necessary because, you know, if you've got 63 people that are voting, then sure, one person might change his mind every other day, but if you've got, like, a few million, chances of strong polarization are very, very low and might actually hint at some bigger problem. Like, I would love to see this kind of law go through in Israel, Palestine. So who can vote? Why need we say, oh, you have to be 18? Because I've never met anybody who's 18 and politically thinking who wasn't politically thinking at 17, right? Any arbitrary limitation is going to damage the entire interaction of the system. So, you know, we can discuss at length whether children have the right to have opinions. I think they do, but, you know, most people might disagree with me. But the important thing is, when people die, why should they have a vote? Why should dead people be able to say anything like this? The oldest law in effect in Iceland right now is from the year 1275. Right? No living Icelander, I hope, has agreed to this law. I mean, you know, I did a recent poll. I was giving a talk last weekend and, you know, asked people there, are you, you know, in support of this law if it were a motion today? And nobody raised their hand. Maybe they were just shy, but, you know. But the fact is that most people don't know what the law says, and it's actually just two articles talking about the rights of churches to own land. So, you know, why should churches own land? Okay, never mind. What we're gaining from all this is a more responsive society. And, you know, it's, you know, the thing that's been going on for century after century after century is that the plutocrats and bureaucrats kind of, you know, they need us to not understand what the law is saying. They need us to you know, not know that there is a law. You know, they need to control the flow of information. And we as free software, free hardware, free anything enthusiasts, free culture enthusiasts, say, no, that's not going to work anymore. Sorry, you know, that day is over. People need to be informed about what the laws are, and you know, if they are, they might actually abide by them. You know, there's a big question that always comes up: whether or not this kind of system will lead to a minimalist or maximalist kind of legal framework. I kind of tend towards thinking that it will be minimalist, because you know, there's going to be that few things that everybody can agree on, but those things are actually really, really good. But that kind of thing just isn't enough. Oh, yeah, then there's support emotions. Anybody who's worked on a few software with people who are very easy at disagreeing, you know? Projects fork. Why can't countries fork? I mean, it might sound crazy, but if people have diverging attitudes towards certain issues, why don't they just break up, settle, you know, settle their differences, go somewhere else?
And South Ossetia.
Yeah, South Ossetia is a great example, and there are many, many good examples.
It's not South Ossetia is not a good example at all. It's a strife. It's conflict.
Yes,
it's
why it won't happen? It doesn't happen. It's an example of the problem.
It's a problem that can't be resolved democratically, and obviously not by military means. So, you know, it just gets, you know, dumbed down every now and then. So
what is your solution to South
Ossetia? Allow people to make up their own mind and.
There are those people, they do make up their minds. They want to go into different directions. One wants to stay and the other one wants to go.
And why don't
so there's no solution. There's no solution.
Sure. Yeah, for example, like the rich don't want to carry the burden of the war.
Okay, a better example.
It's a question of hegemony in the system as well, because if the United States doesn't support it and supports Georgia, and then Russia supports it, but then the United States is more powerful, it's a war system problem as well.
A better example would be Flanders and Wallonia in Belgium.
Yeah, but that is a fit. This example is fit to your purpose. But Ossetia doesn't work.
As an example of problem that exists with countries that want to leave and they can't leave because the system, the way it is now, won't let them go.
The
borders
are too strictly defined.
South Ossetia, Transnistria, there's lots of countries.
It's not a country because there are Georgians in South Ossetia and South Ossetians in South Ossetia.
It was
one
the same
wants
in
to
Kosovo,
stay
but
and the
it
other
happened.
One wants to go.
It was the same in Kosovo, but it did happen for certain reasons, didn't it? So if
but it's not just. It's quite clear that
yes,
I think Kosovo.
It's
geopolitics 101. You know, it's people will not agree on this. If you were voting now, you'd probably vote differently, you know, opposing on this issue. The point is that once you allow people...
Sorry, but I have to interrupt you very shortly. How many people would like to go to dinner with us this evening? Just hands up.
One, two,
after the conference, I think at 8 or something like that.
Okay, shall we democratize money next?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I love this discussion, but I love these slides too, so I kind of dismiss. okay, so, you know, once we've democratized democracy, big challenge, you know, nobody's going to agree with me on this. What happens if we democratize money? Now, what do we mean when we say democratize money? Well, we need to understand what money is. And, you know, everybody's seen that Zeitgeist movie and, but, you know, the fact is that money is very strictly centralized today. There's the way money is defined is a very centralized thing. And we have a very cool means of decentralizing it. It's called PGP. You might have heard of it. But money has a few features, and this is from The Future of Money by Bernard Leiter. So the first feature is it's geographically defined. Separate countries have separate currencies. This is partially used as a method of creating nationalism, withholding the group unity, and also trade as a like very simplified form of trade restriction, just to keep goods from traveling over borders without the government getting a chance to put its finger in. And second is that money is created from nothing. This used to be not the case when we had a gold standard and all that stuff, but today money is literally made out of nothing. And I actually think that this is a good thing because gold is inherently scarce. Like there's only so many gold atoms on the planet, right? And besides, if you bind the value of money to a certain commodity, be it gold or rice or, you know, whatever, concrete, we are always going to have people trying to control that substance. So, like, the Beers Consolidated Mines have the diamond industry completely enthralled. So they control the price of diamonds, and if money were bound to diamonds, then, you know, they would control money as well. But money is created through loans. People take bank loans, but essentially when banks are loaning other banks, and especially central banks are loaning money to the other banks, that is when money is created. That's like the moment of ignition. And that there is the key point, coupled with this one here, the fact that interest is paid on any debt. So when I get a loan, I actually have to pay more money back, which means that, well, can we do the math on this? Like, if there's only £10 existent in the entire system and I borrow it from somebody and they insist that I pay £10.50 back, how am I going to do that? There's no more money in the system. So we always need to create more and more money to solve it. And this is actually what we call a non-zero-sum game. As in, you cannot at any point in time say, okay, let's just sum up all the credit and the debit and, you know, get a zero. Because, you know, we'll always get a huge negative number. And that negative number increases all the time. Negative if you do it one way, positive if you do it the other, never mind. The point is that having a zero-sum game for money would be better. And so how about we change it? How about if Alice wants to buy something from Bob, Alice takes a piece of paper and writes £10 on it, you know, that's the amount, and then she digitally signs it, and then she encrypts that thing and sends it to Bob. And then Bob wants to buy something from Charles and, you know, does exactly the same thing, digitally signs an agreement saying that that he owes Charles £12, and then, you know, Charles might owe Alice £9, and then we resolve the system by everybody just unencrypting the financial statements, essentially, and the entire thing gets zeroed out to the maximum extent possible. Now, of course, this is a very, very simple example. If you were to take the entire network, say the entire network of voters that we had earlier, and just run it through the entire thing, it's a n log n problem if you're into algorithms, then you can actually resolve the entire monetary system at the blink of an eye.
And how about the meaning of if someone gets for a service, for example, I get from Bob, he served me something, and I say I gave 10 euros for it.
Yeah.
And Charles think, okay, this thing he served to me is for me. It's not. It's I need 12 euros or 8 euros.
Oh yeah, yeah.
This thing.
Well,
the system. The
thing is, this
different views of wealth.
Yeah, definitely. This thing doesn't aim at equality, really. This is just a measure of how to trade goods, because people today think that we need a monetary system in order to do things. You know, I kind of don't agree, but since everybody believes it, then, you know, let's give them one that kind of works. At least one that works better than the current model.
Is there a software inside who can manage this?
Oh yeah, there exists a couple of projects. The best one, to my mind, is DFUN. Like, it's not working anymore. The guy who was writing it kind of just said, I've got other projects. But I can dig up the name of it later. I kind of can't remember. You can do all of this just using PGP signatures and a bit of code in between. And the encryption part, I only stick that in there because did you notice the fact that if you encrypt every single financial transaction, then there is no way that any government can taxate you? Right? And taxation is the foundation of government. If there is no taxes, then there is no government. But okay, so, you know, that's basically how this works. And okay, so that's kind of like two of the nine ideas. That's the monetary system, that's a democratic system. We still need to deal with a bunch of stuff. One of the great things is, like, the monetary system is different from the economy. The economy, well, especially the materials economy, which is kind of what the entire talk was supposed to be about. originally. Sorry, I kind of broke that idea. The materials economy question, or like how things flow between each other. There was somebody who mentioned it during during the first session, the work of Stafford Beer. Who's familiar with him? Yeah, it was you, yeah. Okay, Stafford Beer was, I think he was from Manchester, in fact. He was a cyberneticist back in the 70s, and well, and very long after that. And in 1971, he was hired by Salvador Allende, the president of Chile, to go to Chile and build what would essentially be called the internet today. It was a long link of teletype machines connected through the phone lines that were supposed to take statistical information from the companies, from the mines, from everywhere where things are being produced, push it back and forth. Actually, it was very hierarchical the way they organized it. There was this big data center in Santiago that was supposed to deal with all the statistical output. But this system called CyberSyn.
What is it called?
Can you write down the names?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, that's...
okay, so CyberSyn, there's actually this really, really great talk he gave in 1972 called, it had a name, I'm sure. So it was a really good talk in 1972 when the project was alive and well and really doing some awesome stuff. And then in 1973, on the 11th of September actually, oddly enough, the CIA sponsored Augusto Pinochet to assassinate Allende and take over the country of Chile, with the effect, which might not have been obvious at the time to the people who weren't paying attention, that CyberSyn was killed. And CyberSyn was essentially the internet. It was not the internet as we know it today, but it was a market economy. It was like the entire data stream of the economy pushed into cyberspace. And the reason that the kind of reason that's normally speculated why CIA sponsored this is that they wanted to keep the world price of copper down, because Chile produces most of the copper in the world, and any sort of high level high tech information system that would alert workers on how royally they're being screwed would definitely change the world price of copper. So you could say that the CIA killed the internet in order to save the internet. I don't know. So that there is essentially just a plug-in solution to the economic problem, because we have the internet. All we need to do is find some way of regulating or organizing all the information and put it out there. And when you take that coupled with a peer-to-peer distributed mutualist monetary system, and stick it in with a democracy where people actually have something to say, then we get a lot of things. So I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Most of this work is actually being done to some extent. Those are my nine little things. Each of them exists in a kind of separate vacuum at the moment, but I've been trying to push so that they all work together in some way. And at the core of it is the identity infrastructure, which for people in like first world countries, we kind of don't recognize the importance of that kind of infrastructure. It kind of just, we have good databases that take care of us. We don't need a better system. But by completely using the Ubuntu philosophy, saying that I am who I am because of who you all are, then I can be defined, my existence can be defined, not by some centralized database run by the government, but by you guys, by you pledging for me, essentially, and I for you similarly. And, all of these things, they're really cool. So I'm just going to end up by pointing out a few books. I kind of missed a lot of really good ones, but, it'll give you something to think about. And any questions?
I have one. It's really a question. How would you solve the following problem? in the Netherlands, we have, we talked about it already.
Yeah.
We have an airport. There are people living around the airport. And if you expand the airport, there's a group, small number of people that is going to be, they have to move or something.
Mm-hmm.
How does your system solve this? Well, it is a problem because there's a small number of people that will vote against this, probably themselves.
Yeah.
But the large number of people say, "Yeah, I want the airport." It's not in my backyard issue.
Yeah. Definitely.
How would your system solve this? Or
well, my system doesn't solve it.
No.
That's the truth, and it doesn't really have to because people are supposed to solve it. This entire thing is about people at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And you know, all I'm trying to do is improve the infrastructure so that people can solve things better.
Aren't you afraid that the democracy as it is in place now, at least in the Netherlands, I don't really know it in the other countries, if you would transfer it to something more of this, that it would
you're worried
be
about mob rule.
More a populist thing. The large amount of people would decide for.
Yeah.
The small amount of, if we all decide together,
exactly.
The Jews should be dead. Have a real extreme one. It could be done.
Definitely, definitely those things worry me. But the point about the Jews being dead, Hitler was never actually popularly voted. He
was
a minority.
He had a majority. He was
selected by Reichstag.
A genuine democratic majority.
Oh, well, okay, never mind, you know.
So please get your history right.
Yeah, no, I have this from fairly good references, but never mind.
That's a matter of fact. That's it. There is some truth to that.
Yeah.
I mean, might be some place in the internet where it arrives differently, but according to my standards of truth, it is important that Hitler was elected by the majority of German people, and there is no discussion about this.
The point is,
it's about your scarcity. Space, for example.
Yeah, space is scarce, and there is the option of the fourth motion. So people who live on land can just say, "Oh, we're not going to participate in this anymore. We're going to leave."
Yeah.
And then it comes down to questions of human rights. Do we have the right to make new states? Do we have the right to not be invaded if we decide that Schiphol Airport is going to be our new city,
So you have to handle it and live on, actually.
Yeah.
That's one of the purposes.
Let's say, I'm trying to resist my own trend to discard a lot of what you have proposed based on some things that I find inconsistent with my vision of a reality, because I think it would be a wrong attitude. Because you are asked, I find some of the questions you are asking deeply right, like the question about democratizing democracy. I think this is a true question. My doubts about the answer you bring. But what strikes me is. You have really a focus on an ideal system, which means that things like transition issues or intermediate stage when you have power, for example, you have everyone can change his votes all the time. It's a paradise of spin doctors. Things like that. These are not taken in account. So there is a kind of something which is, I have a respect for complexity, and I feel hurt by the fact that by looking only at projecting the idea, you arm, let's say you do not take in account the complexity of the present.
Definitely. Like the entire media thing, like how do we make sure that it doesn't become a media frenzy and democracy be... It's definitely questions that need to be tackled. I think that, with the further democratization of the other stuff, the production, the media, the, all of these foundations, this thing will become less and less of a threat. Like, while there's still people who are controlling the means of information flow, then you know any sort of idea like this is very prone to issues.
Let's say to be more constructive. Yeah. Okay, when people started to argue for universal vote,
yeah,
they the opponents say, you know, these are damn idiots and they don't know even how to read and and there was a conscious decision not to wait. Mm-hmm. I mean, to put in place at the same time some processes for people to become more educated and know to read, and the universal vote, and not to wait till. So I understand that, but you can have strategies like that where you make bets by you don't wait for people to be perfect because before you make a system that builds on that.
Exactly.
But that was because you were not doing that for everything at the same time.
The thing that was hidden here was that there are transitional stages. Kind of hinted at it with the website democracy.is, which kind of works as a kind of transition. Essentially, what's happening now is people are slowly hearing about it and, you know, going in and placing their vote, and, you know, we're doing all sorts of stuff to fix it into social networking, so there'll be a Facebook application and whatnot. And hopefully, at some point, we'll have enough mass behind it that one of two things will happen. Either parliamentarians will start doing exactly what is said on there, in which case they're proving themselves obsolete, or they will consciously decide to ignore it, in which point, in which case they're proving themselves to be at contrast with the general populace. Either way, they kind of shoot themselves.
What if they copy it or they try to co-opt it and make their own government?
Well, they will. They will. We'll probably have to deal with it.
I mean, let me take up an innocent example, the example of the voting age.
Okay.
I mean, your point, I'm sympathized with your point. Your point, of course, is well taken that arbitrarily putting the voting age at 18 years. It's not as specific as you would like to. Now, on the other hand, if you are 2 or 3 or 4 years, what you are going to do is do exactly what your parents told you to do. Now, and there is just no way.
I know lots of 25-year-olds who do that.
But there is just no way to, in any detail, to determine at which particular time a child would be autonomous enough so that it could vote. Now, this is an impossible, it's a completely impossible problem, and the way the society dealt with it is to have an arbitrary, an arbitrary limit. Now, what any relaxation of this arbitrary limit, say to in Reykjavik they are allowed to do it with 7, whereas in Copenhagen whatever they are allowed to do it with 7.5. That's just the same arbitrary.
Definitely. Which one option for that?
I don't know any other.
We're running out of time, actually. As I understand.
Can you say something to this? You are totally right, but you could consider it as a set of experiments. So the information coming out of such limited arbitrary decisions might be very valuable for the whole global system. We might discover what works and what doesn't work.
Yes?
So I think that your positions... There's two different stages I would like to make. One is between abundance and scarcity, and one is about micro and macro. Right?
Okay.
So, for example, whenever something is abundant, then there's absolutely no problem with applying some of your ideas because you're not hurting anybody else. A good example is in free software. As long as we're making the free software, we have a self-regulating community, but when we're talking about the servers that are needed, then we have foundations that are democratically regulated, because it affects the whole community. And so the problem in Georgia or in South Asia is confusion of scarcity and abundance, because political power is related to scarce resources, so nobody wants to give them up. If you could split up and say, for example, say we can have cultural autonomy, and that wouldn't affect the political then people wouldn't be afraid to give them autonomy, because so we have to learn to distinguish between fields of scarcity and abundance and modulate, because it's polarity, there's no real distinction, so this kind of hybrid thing is weird. And the other thing is between micro and micro, what I think what you're doing, this is very useful, is as communities of people who want to be autonomous, like we want as much as we can control our destinies, and therefore we hack whatever we can, which is democracy, money, etc. But we apply this in our own communities first.
Definitely.
Okay. And if it works, then we can talk to the macro society and say, well, if you try this out, this might work for you, right?
Yes.
But we shouldn't dream that we can, you know, like wildly say, you know, let's have this kind of voting system or monetary system. But first of all, because we don't have the power, and secondly, because you don't know all the possible negative consequences that we may have. So we need to try it first ourselves, and have monetary systems that work within our community.
Or non-monetary systems.
Or non-monetary systems. We can have.
So there's
and out of the experience, we can talk in terms of policy to the macro society.
In terms of scale, there's a few really neat sociological and mathematical principles at work. One is Dunbar's law, or Dunbar's number, from Robin Dunbar, an anthropologist who said that human societies are essentially limited to 150 people, or that's like the tribal community. Once they grow bigger than that, then the interrelationships between any given pair of people is just unmanageable. And by way of Metcalfe's law, you've got 150 people turns out to be about 11,175 connections between pairs. And come on, who's going to be able to manage that? You know, so there's those two laws. There's Metcalfe's law, there's Dunbar's law. And then you've got the other two, which are essentially the 6 degrees of separation on one hand, and then that thing on the other. The thing that I was talking with Martin about earlier, which was that in any system, a system is called self-organizing if redundancy increases over time. And redundancy is defined as 1 minus the entropy divided by the maximum possible entropy in the system. So the more redundant a system becomes, the more slack it has, the more capability it has to deal with new experiments.
I agree with a lot of what you've said. One thing that I thought was maybe missing and I'm going to say to that is the whole issue of peak oil. And we're actually, we've actually got, all the industrial society has been built on the large availability of fossil fuels. We've now, it looks very likely, passed kind of peak oil last year. Peak gas and peak coal are probably not far away. Plus we've got the ecological consequences of burning all this fossil fuel in terms of climate change. So, I mean, you know, all the infrastructure that's been built up on really available fossil fuel is,
It's definitely very, very much broken. And I'm hoping that the open hardware movement as a whole will be able to take care of that. Like, we have somebody here working on an open source car. he was here last night. We kind of like we have movements that are working on these problems, and you know, essentially they're related and yet somewhat tangential. So, you know, I completely agree. Peak oil is a problem. Climate change is messed up.
There's a small thing you can also attribute to that. So, the link to scarcity and maybe renewability, because we all thought that oil was endless with all of us. And so scarcity only exists at the point that it happens. And usually that happens later than that you could see it coming. And I think
then there's also the artificial controls on these resources. The OECD, the OPEC countries saying, oh no, we're only going to sell this many barrels this year.
But is it artificial because it's theirs?
They are scarcifying something that everybody else needs. I mean, I'm not saying that the oil in the ground isn't scarce, but they definitely have a lot of regulations and you know, a regulatory capability or capacity.
Yeah, but it's the opposite situation as the airport situation.
Yeah.
They're sitting on oil.
Yeah.
and they can do with it what they want.
Yeah,
create scarcity or not.
Mm-hmm. And we kind of need to have to deal with it. We can, you know, find something that isn't scarce.
I just wanted to mention, you use a category, rivalrous goods.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you're aware of, others might also be interested in, the concept of positional consumption. This was called, termed positional goods, as opposed to public goods. An economist called Fred Hirsch wrote a book called Social Limits to Growth in the 1970s, early 1970s. And that's really, really very, very important when I was concerned about the material economy, because a lot of things are turned into positional goods.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even a job can be turned into a positional good. Like, if you limit the number of jobs for doctors that there are, then that becomes an object of consumption. And, and people consume a lot. They produce an awful lot of consumption is driven by the need to get your child into university, a good university where they can become a doctor. And then if you prioritise education, it then becomes, it's part of all the engines of inequality.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to mention Hirsch.
I've never heard of it. What's the name?
Fred Hirsch.
Fred Hirsch.
Yeah.
I'll have to remember that somehow.
It's also in Daniel Bell, Towards the Post-Industrial Society, when he thinks about what will be scarce in the with the abundance of information.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions positions. And, he has quite elaborate discussion.
There are
I don't agree with the book, but it was visionary nonetheless.
There are ways to deal with position, positionary goods. For example, one of the ideas there is peer-to-peer education, where I've always really hated the education system in that it forces me to come and sit down at lectures day after day after day, and at the end of 3 years I suddenly magically get an education. You know, I mean, of course it's not like that, but the way the degrees are structured, you don't get an education until you've suddenly got the paper. And you know, I kind of dislike that. So the idea of peer-to-peer education for me is partially the idea of people teaching each other, and you know, that way we're kind of ridding ourselves of the positionary things in education by saying, if you want to learn something, find somebody who can teach it to you. But there's so many things to worry about in that thing. So.
The classic positionary goods argument you've got is a river. You know, if you live next to the river, you have water.
Mm.
If you don't, you don't.
Yeah.
Right, unless you've got a good rain and water harvesting system.
Yeah. That's hard to deal with. Okay. So,
how
are we for time?
We're okay for time. Are there more questions, or shall we? So, appreciation
the usual way? Well, you can come chat afterwards if you want. I'm personally more comfortable with that kind of format. I kind of sweat when I'm in front of a lot of people.
Oh, I'm assuming that it's just, because I just missed the whole thing. Have you been recorded? And
somebody's, I think, two different recordings.
Slides read somewhere.
Yeah, and the slides, they're all, first of all, Creative Commons, meaning that you can do with them what you wish. So many slides.
We will put all the slides in every other documentation that's recorded on the website.
You see the URL at the bottom? yaksic.org/talks2009. It's not there yet. I had problems getting online, but... it will be there, and it's under Creative Commons and open document format. So feel free.
Thank you very much.